My brother keeps a human head in his closet. I hope I don't end up that way.
This thing, it's gonna follow you. Somebody gave it to me. And I passed it to you. It could look like someone you know, or it could be a stranger in a crowd. It could look like anyone.
Help! Santa Claus only brings presents to them that's been good all year. To the ones that ain't done nothing naughty. All the other ones. All the naughty ones. He punishes. You see Santa Claus tonight, you better run, boy. You better run for your life.
Bring me one of those chickens.
You got money to pay for it?
You paid for it.
No, but we're the king's men. So, you got money?
Not a penny. I'll still take that chicken.
You don't seem to understand the situation.
I understand that if any more words come pouring out your mouth, I'm going to have to eat every chicken in this room.
You lived your life for the king. You're gonna die for some chickens.
Someone is.
The symbol is associated with a pagan deity named Bagul. He consumes the souls of human children. Early Christians believed that Bagul actually lived in the images themselves and that they were gateways into his realm.
I am seriously positive these were not here. How would we have, just made a campsite in between three piles of rocks just by coincidence?
You don't think this is strange?
Hello, again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you, sir?
I'm exhausted.
Indeed, from a 17 and a half hour work day yesterday here.
Yes.
It happens. At work, I had to pick up someone else's work today because they had something due today and they couldn't finish it.
F the slackers.
Indeed. Indeed. And in the state of New York?
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how are you, sir?
Also exhausted, but not for 17 hours.
There you go. And in the state of Massachusetts?
Hi, everyone. It's Dave.
Dave, how's it going?
I'm doing well.
Excellent. All right, so we usually have another co-host, but she cannot be with us this week. Either way, this is Dark Discussions Podcast, where we discuss horror films, sci-fi, fantasy thrillers, techno-thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, arthouse, midnight movies, cult films, and whatnot, dissect and critique, and basically try to talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. Our website is darkdiscussions.com, and our email is darkdiscussions@aol.com, and our Facebook group, where there's a lot of talk, is Dark Discussions Podcast. Just search for that on Facebook. We have a lot of stuff going on right now. We're talking big on Westworld. Christina Jones, a newly added member to the group, she probably found us through the Westworld podcast, and she joined, and it's a big discussion this week about Westworld, even though it is in hiatus. It's pretty good stuff. A lot of good, interesting topics where Eric was picking on me, as usual.
Yes. Yes. Well, if you weren't so very wrong all the time, I wouldn't have to pick on you so much.
Well, when it comes to robots, dude, I don't trust them. You got to remember, robots are made by people, therefore they suck too.
I welcome our robot overlords.
But they suck too, because they were made by people.
I never said they don't suck.
All right, fair enough. That's a good point. You never did. Tonight we have a new topic, but before we do that, we'll have one thing we're going to do. All the news and house cleaning we'll do at the end of the episode, but it is the first week of April, or the first week of quarter two of 2019. And as we know, it's a Patreon poll. So we got a new Patreon poll tonight. And
that's right. Phil, let me jump in here for a second just to catch anybody up who's new. We have a Patreon account that you can find a link for on the front page of darkdiscussions.com. You can also go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. And for every $5 a month that you care to donate to help offset the cost of producing this podcast, you'll have the opportunity to submit a topic for us to possibly cover on the show. We draw all the entries from all our patrons on a quarterly basis, and that's what's happening here tonight.
Indeed, indeed. So we're going to be randomly picking a number tonight. And Mike, you actually have a generator up, a computer generator from the web.
Yep.
All right. And so let's see what we got.
Okay, I just sent it to you there, Phil.
All right. And what number is that, Mike?
It is number 356.
356. Okay. And ooh, almost falling down, Eric. We were off by one.
Oh, okay.
But we got a Holly Masiak pick.
Okay.
And Holly Masiak asked us to do the cult classic Devil's Advocate.
Oh, no kidding.
Keanu Reeves, right?
Yep, Keanu Reeves, Al Pacino, Charlize Theron, and Connie
like
Nielsen.
Connie Theron! Okay, sorry.
A lot of full frontal nudity of two hot chicks.
Yes,
Phil. Oh, Lord.
but where's the full Pacino? That's
well, this was like one of his first movies that his voice is like completely different than when it was when he was younger.
Mm-hmm.
It's that weird husky voice now that he has versus the whiny voice from the good old days.
Totally fits here, though.
I don't know if it was his first, because I mean, this is 97. This is a good 5 years, I'm thinking, after Hoo Ha! You know.
So, all right. So, that's good. So, Devil's Advocate, that's a pretty good film. And that will be coming up shortly when we have an opening. Next week, we already have a brand new film that's coming out that we're probably going to do. So, we'll find a spot.
I don't know if we're going to do something right after that either. That depends on that interest and probably the reviews.
So we'll figure it out. We'll figure it out. Yep.
And just so everybody's aware, it looks like you can, if you're interested in catching up on The Devil's Advocate, if for some reason you haven't seen it yet, it is available pretty much to stream almost everywhere. Looks like Google Play, YouTube, Fandango Now, PlayStation, Microsoft, Vudu for $2.99. So... you know, you should have access to most of those. I guess, wow, it's not
I
on
actually
Amazon.
Own it on DVD.
I do as well.
And you can stream it for free on something I've never seen before, IMDb Free Dive, but it has ads. So. Now, I have no idea if it's like one of those you have to watch an ad at the beginning and then you can watch it all the way through, which is, I think, what Hulu does. Or is it break it up?
Interesting.
Like,
I don't know.
You know. ABC.
I don't know. I pay money so I don't have to deal with ads.
It'll be curious too because the disc that we probably all have has the original version. But since then, they've changed one scene. Basically, there's that big statue, white statue with all the naked people.
Mm-hmm.
It actually does exist, that statue, and the creator was upset that it was used in the film and used in the way it was that they had to cut out like when it comes alive.
Jesus, fuck that guy.
Yeah. So it's a weird thing. So yeah, if you get the new disc, it changed it a little and
lame.
Yeah. So our disc is somewhat of a collector's item and you get more full frontal nudity in it.
The thing that matters to Phil.
Well, yeah. So, I guess that's it for that. Any other items anybody wanted to bring up?
We'll do it later.
All right, yeah. Okay, sounds good. All right, so with all that stated, Eric, why don't you let everybody know what we're going to discuss tonight?
Tonight, we're going to be talking about a movie called Braid.
Wow.
That's where you're going?
Watch where I'm going, asshole.
So, how do you want to do this? We'll need to search the whole house to find the safe. To do so, we're gonna have to play the game. Once we get into the house, whatever she asks you to do, you're gonna have to do it. No excuses. She says we obey.
Mom, the doctor's here!
Welcome back, doctor. Rule number one,
everyone must play.
Sorry.
Rule number two, no outsiders allowed.
Rule number three, nobody leaves.
That's right. 2019 film called Braid, as in a French braid or hair braid. The film did the festival circuits in 2018 and then got a release about, I don't know, maybe 4 weeks ago. It's released by a company called Blue Fox Entertainment. It's getting 88% good reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, including 3.5 out of 4 stars from RogerEbert.com website. It's by a first
not
time.
Not to be confused with Roger Ebert, who's been long deceased.
Exactly. They just keep using his name. They've done it for years. It's directed first time director, or at least director of a full length feature called Mitzi Pieroni, who is from Italy originally, and has done a little acting on the side prior to becoming a director. Stars basically three folks. Madeline Brewer, most known for the Hulu's television series The Handmaid's Tale. Imogen Waterhouse is probably the true lead. And she plays a character called Petula. Madeline Brewer plays a character called Daphne. And then Sarah Hay plays a character called Tilda. So it's basically three women, directed by a woman, written by a woman, and a woman perspective. Let's see. I think that's all I got there. So I guess we can go around and discuss how we heard about this film and what we thought about it. So let's start with you, Eric Webster.
Oh boy, you really want to start with me. All right. I heard about this film because Phil has not stopped talking about it since the beginning of the year. And we finally agreed to do an episode on it. I did not enjoy this movie one bit. I think it's pretentious. I think a lot of the camera work in the movie is done just for the sake of being stylistic. It was not entertaining. I did not enjoy it. My friend Dan, who watched the movie with me, was very angry about having watched the movie with me. and I would rather watch a double feature of Dave Made a Maze and The Gallows than watch this again. So, not a fan. I won't watch this movie again. And I won't belabor the point. That's all I have to say about it.
All right. Very good. For me, I actually heard about the film, I think originally through Rotten Tomatoes. When it releases weekly upcoming films, and I always look for genre films, and this one popped up and got really good reviews, as I stated, and it was one that I bumped around earlier in the year, then nothing came of it. I just had it on the back burner. I did buy the disc or pre-order it, and it finally came a couple of weeks ago, but then Jason Lloyd of Horror Failure and Buddy Bits, my Buddy Bits, said that it was one of his top five films of the year so far, and he had already seen a number of films at South by Southwest. So his list is pretty huge right now, and yet this film still makes his top five. And I think it's number four. So I suggested it. We had an opening, so we decided to watch it. Again, I had the disc, so I watched it a couple nights ago, Sunday night, I think it was. And Eric had already mentioned offline to me that he and Dan didn't like it. So I was like very nervous and disappointed that I was going to have to see a film that would suck. But I did watch it, and I have to say it's my favorite horror film of the year. Possibly one of the, similar to what Chrissy said last week about Us, one of the better horror films I've seen in the past 5 years. I love this film. It has an awesome soundtrack, very much Quentin Tarantino cult styling film at the beginning. And then it switches into a kind of a film that tries to trick you, and you try to figure out what's going on. And then at the end, you kind of get what happens. So I watched it a second time right after, and you can see there's so many things that now make sense once you watch it a second time. It worked really good watching it a second time. I would highly recommend this film. Again, I will agree with Eric that it has a certain taste. You'll have to have a certain taste for the film. It is kind of reminded me of more of a, I guess, art house horror film, even though it had a Quentin Tarantino style at the beginning, because it kind of switches tones. So it's definitely for a specific audience. But big thumbs up by me. High recommend. Abe.
So the first time I heard about this film was really when we were trying to decide what we were going to discuss for next week. I made sure to watch it earlier today to kind of keep everything fresh in my mind. And for me, I honestly think this is one of my least favorite films of this year. This film, I really just could not get into. I found some of the performances obnoxious. I thought a lot of the camera work, as Eric has said, was very pretentious. A lot of times they try to use things for just style and not really for any real reason, because they thought it looked artsy. I found certain moments more annoying than actually intense or interesting. And even for 80 minutes, it felt like it dragged. I could not really get into any part of this film. I was mostly just, I literally had to take breaks in between. I literally take breaks in between because it was becoming too much to deal with. It was such a pain in the ass to sit through. And I'm not going to, if I was to compare it to the three worst films we had seen, like They Made Maze or The Gallows, I would say this one made me not as angry as The Gallows did, but I found it is much more annoying than The Gallows. But I found it, not almost as pretentious as They Made Maze. So it's a film that I just, it had everything that I just did not like in a horror film in terms of those kinds of those elements, those kind of problems. I could never sit through this again. And not even if my liver destroyed by alcohol, I could never do it. this movie I just couldn't. But it's not the worst film it's one of my least favorite. I doubt it will be the worst. I mean, we have an entire year still left for some prizes, but
keep it positive there, Abe.
Yeah, let's keep it positive, and I'll just say I can't recommend it to anyone.
All right, very good. Mike.
Yeah, I got 16 minutes into the movie, and I realized that if I didn't have to watch for the podcast, I would have stopped it right then and there. And my opinion of the film didn't really end up changing. Throughout, I'm kind of going to echo what the other guys said. I really actually resented the time I had to spend watching the movie. There is a twist at the end that makes some of what you watched make sense. I'm sure there's all sorts of stuff, and I read some stuff that, you know, like little Easter eggs that they put in there to try to explain what was going on. But the problem is, which has come up on the podcast before, you know, if you don't enjoy watching it the first time, you're not likely to watch it the second time to get that extra thing out of the viewing. And I don't think this is something for me. This was not something like Sixth Sense or Jacob's Ladder, or where you watch the movie and it makes sense until there's a twist, and then the movie makes sense in a completely different way. It's just, for me, the movie was completely jarring and off-putting, and I'm sure that was probably intentional. I just, you know, wasn't what I'm looking for in a film. It's not what I enjoy in a film. You know, I think, like, even the editing was like, there were jarring cuts throughout the film. And that kind of keeps you off balance. And again, knowing now what I know about the film, that was probably an intentional thing. But it's sort of like, you know, if you have food that's really spicy, you might say, well, the cook accidentally added too much spice to the broth. But maybe that's actually what they wanted to do, but it doesn't mean that you're going to enjoy it. So, yeah, I've said I don't like, in the, you know, in previous things, I don't like overly pretentious camera work, you know, where, and it's a really fine line to tell. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. Here was just an example where I felt like it was being done to show that it was being done. Going back to that film that I can't remember what it's called. The man child who has to take care of his mother when his father dies.
Oh, The Living and the Dead by Simon.
The Ray. Living and the Dead, right? Where there was Simon, where was that like extended 10 or 200 minute sequence where it felt like, you know, they threw every camera trick that they learned in film school in a brief bit that again felt like here was like looking at all the stuff that I could do since I have money to spend on a film and I've got these tools to use. I'm going to use all of them now. And you know, that's what a lot of it kind of felt like. Again, I think it's intentional. I think it's intending to keep the audience off balance. But that didn't make it a pleasant viewing experience for me.
All right. One question, Mike. The first 15 minutes, besides the prelude, is a completely different film than the rest of the film. And yet you didn't like the Quentin Tarantino, the train sequence or the drug.
Well, that's really stuff. Yeah, this is not, I want to be clear, this is not like From Dusk Till Dawn, where it's a Tarantino movie for the first hour and then becomes something different. This is a two girls are on the run from the police and get on a train. And I don't even know if that's a full 15 minutes. I don't remember what exactly happened in 15 minutes. If that was when they got to the friend's house, but all that stuff, it's not tonally a different film. It's just plot wise, a different film. And I just think even we're playing within the rules of the world they're in. There's just stuff that doesn't make sense narratively when you're watching it the first time, you know? And yeah, it makes sense narratively after you watch it. But it just, for me, it's just not worth going through to go, oh, because that's just not good storytelling. Again, something like Jacob's Ladder, the narrative makes sense the first time through and then makes a different kind of sense the second time through. This was just meh, like that. And I would have other questions. Maybe they'd be answered, but I don't really care enough to go back and see it again to do it.
All right, very well. I was thinking that was going to happen with you co-host. That's why I was praying that Chrissy would get on, because I think she may have actually been more apt to like it as I did, as well as some of our listeners like Chris Genro and Jason Lloyd. But no worries.
I went on Reddit after this was over.
Red Bull and Reddit.
And just was curious to see what other people thought, because I know you know, were ready to ride this thing to the end. And I was like, all right, is there something I'm missing? And pretty much everyone, and a lot, there were people there who loved it, and there were people there who absolutely hated it. So this is going to be a very divisive film. Just in this particular case, with four people, the division comes down 3-1 instead of 2-2, or 1-3. So I'm not going to say don't watch it. I'm just going to say it is not a particularly typical film. So, yeah, 10 minutes in is when they arrive at the house.
Oh, all right. So that quick. Okay.
Yeah, so it's there. So, yeah, that whole thing of them on the train.
In the drug lab, too.
Yeah, that, 7 minutes. So, yeah, that's, I mean, yeah, that's nothing. It's a prelude.
Yeah.
I gotta agree with what Abe was saying about the runtime on this movie. There was one point where you can do something to make the time elapsed come up and view it. And at one point during the movie, I brought it up and it said there were 30 minutes left. I was like, oh, are you fucking kidding me? Because it felt like I'd already been watching it for an hour and a half.
Yeah. It felt like that for me when I was at the last 20-minute mark. I was like, Jesus Christ, it never ends.
Yeah, so it's definitely, as you said, Mike, a divisive film, especially like you actually saw it firsthand by going to Reddit and seeing people saying it was awesome and people that said that it was not so good.
Oh, yeah, and it's some people love it, and it's like they – and there were people who did not get it, and I get that, I guess. I understood it at the end. Kind of. I don't know that it makes a lot of sense logically on at least on one watch. I have all sorts of questions when the plot twist is revealed. Maybe you've watched it a second time. You can explain some of those things. But again, the only reason I'd want those questions answered now is because we're doing a podcast on it. I would otherwise be perfectly happy to just, you know, walk away from this film otherwise.
Right. All right. Sounds good. So,
and by the way, for Eric, if my choice was to watch this or The Phantom for 10,000 Leagues, I'm taking the ricin. That's my, all right.
There you go. All right. So, Eric, do we have a wiki by chance?
Wiki. All right. Two wanted women decide to rob their wealthy psychotic friend who lives in the fantasy world they created as children. To take the money, they have to take part in a deadly, perverse game of make-believe.
All right, so right there, fantasy could possibly make it sound art house, which some may say it is. But yeah, basically, it's two women. One is a semi-known actress. Supposedly, they're out of New York City. A semi-known actress and her friend, obviously they aren't making big money, so they're doing drug deals with some
they're at rock bottom
dealer, and as they're counting the drugs and putting them into little packets or whatever to sell, the cops arrive and they have to bolt and they have to leave the drugs. Unfortunately, they had to leave the drugs, so the cops know this room or apartment or whatever it is theirs, so they know who had the drugs. And another problem is now they're $80,000 in the hole because they now owe the dealer $80,000 of drugs that the cops now have. So they flee from New York City back to their hometown of Montpelier, Vermont, where their wealthy friend is living in her inherited home, who we find out is mentally challenged, I guess, somewhat disturbed.
Oh, fucking nuts.
Fucking nuts, yeah.
Yeah, so basically, as children, the three used to hang out together all the time and play a game where one was a mother, one was a daughter, and one was a doctor. And this woman, who now inherited the mansion from her grandparents, is now still playing this game every time they return home to Montpelier.
She's pretty much forever in La La Land, and basically the girls have to come up with a plan to get to the safe while playing her game because they don't want to set her off.
Right. So they want to break into the woman's safe, her their friend's safe, because she has cash in there, and they're going to use that $80,000 to pay off the drug dealer if they can get the cash. And then I don't know what they're going to do about the cops, because they're still going to be in trouble with the cops. But at least they're not going to be wanted dead by a drug dealer. And that's pretty much the setup, right? Anybody have anything else to add about the setup?
Nope.
Not really.
Yeah, that's it. I think from this point on, we kind of have to get into spoiler warnings, I think. That's me.
I would agree with that. Yeah. This is similar to a lot of films that we've been covering recently, where the only way you can talk about it is spoiling it.
But it doesn't start with a child in the backseat of a car talking about an anus. So that's new.
And definitely a mark against it.
Yeah. Well,
at least they're not walking through a cardboard maze.
That was last year.
But you know, they might do it again. Evil never dies.
Now that the anus joke, that was the hole in the ground. Was that?
No, that was us.
That was both.
Oh.
Yeah, right. It was us.
It's
a
definite theme this year, is right. Children that begin first 5 minutes of a movie saying the word anus from the backseat of a car and getting in trouble for saying so.
Right. The weird thing about the hole in the ground is the child was in the front seat, which I
or
guess
whatever.
Is,
okay.
I guess no, but my point is, I guess that's legal in Ireland because it's not legal in the United States. You have to be in the back seat. But anyway, all right. So we'll throw up the spoiler alert and we'll discuss everything and anything about this film. So the spoiler alert is up. If you don't want anything spoiled, please go and rent the film. It's available on Vudu and Prime, I think, Amazon Prime, maybe iTunes. But it's available on VOD, basically. All right, spoilers up. All right, so the first our lead two characters. I actually liked them at first because I like that gritty underground druggy stuff that we see in like Pulp Fiction-y stuff.
It was like 30 seconds and then they had to run out of the house.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. It was quick.
Honestly, I think one of the major problems with this film was I did not like the main characters. I didn't really like any of the characters. So when shit went down, it was hard for me really to really care about them, and it just became even more. And I think I just developed a sense of apathy as the film kept going on, because eventually, you know, there's really, really no one to really be invested in. It's really just watching a weird, weirdly shot shit show of colors and people being nuts.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's definitely, as Mike said, it's in the category of Jacob's Ladder and those type of films. They're on the train heading to Montpelier, and sure enough, yes, Montpelier is a fairly big hub for trains, believe it or not. They even have trains that go up to Quebec. Let's see, the scene where, there's a scene where she's chewing one of the girls, which is the Petulia, which is the lead girl. That's the semi-famous actress. Chews gum, she puts it underneath the seat. She heads to the restroom and gets chased by the train man, because as we know, people have used trains, you don't pay or buy tickets necessarily until you get on the train, and she doesn't have a ticket, and so basically he's gonna rat her out to the cops, and instead they have sex in the bathroom or something. So the druggies, they're willing to use their body to get away from crime. So they're on the run from the cops. So yeah, I can see why, Abe, you may have been a little bit like, yeah, these characters I don't really like too much.
Well, they don't give us any entrance for sympathy or empathy for them, because unless you're, I guess, a drug dealer, you know nothing about them other than they're there. They're happy as a pig in shit that they have money. You know, well, my dad's gonna shit his pants or something when he finds out I paid out, you know, already paid off an $80,000 student loan. And oh shit, then they run out, they leave, and you get no sense of who they are, why they are in that lifestyle, or what, you know, I've seen plenty of movies with sympathetic drug dealers and the criminals on the lam. You know, weirdly enough, I'm, you know, mentioning From Dusk Till Dawn at the beginning of the podcast, earlier in the podcast, you know, as horrible as the Gecko brothers were, there were parts of me that kind of liked them, or, you know, it's, even if they were absolutely horrible people. I just didn't find anything that made me want to like these characters. And, I don't know. And then as we find out later, everything that happens, I don't understand just keeps asking more questions. But like, so, but now it does introduce like, ooh, here's a little bit of a mystery, because the porter or whatever it is, the conductor on the train, calls her Miss something. And turns out like he's a submissive, and he basically lets her on the train as long as he gets something like 5 minutes of licking her foot. So that would imply to me that he knows her somehow, either that she also sides as a prostitute, or she has one of those video sex services or something like that. That he recognizes her from. You know, and I'm kind of waiting, will any of that ever show up again? But, you know, it never does. Again, there's a reason for that, sort of. But, yeah, so, yeah, I like I said, I don't know that I got a whole lot out of this,
well,
as far as that goes.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, basically, once they get to Montpelier, they're basically in the mansion the rest of the film. So, unless whatever their lifestyle was back in New York, wouldn't necessarily play unless you're talking to the third girl, Daphne, about it. And since, yeah, I mean, based off of what we learned, Daphne appears that she doesn't know much about their lifestyle at all. I think that some folks, critics, have stated that it felt like the characters from Spring Breakers or the movie Bully. So yeah, it's fairly unsympathetic characters that generally appear to bring the problems to themselves based off of their, narcissistic lifestyles, maybe.
Mm. Yeah, and I actually didn't mind. What's the lead character's name?
Petula.
Petula, right. And Petula at least seems to have, like, I'm taking care of, begins with a T.
Oh, Tilda?
Tilda. So it seemed like she was taking care of Tilda, you know, and so, like, you know, having sex, or not having sex, but letting her foot get licked by the guy, so that way they don't get kicked off the train. So I'm willing to kind of go there, but that, you know, again, that's a relationship that's not
explored.
Very well.
Yeah, we only get slight hints of things, but honestly, there's not much about actual like bond or a reason why anything that's told conveyed to us about why they're friends or anything like that, how they both ended up in the same place and stuff like that. So seeing them think further as the film goes on is hard to really get even bothered. Upset about, because they've already were, you know, just terrible people. Tilda, you know, in comparison, she takes a complete 180 towards like the third act of the film.
And again, it kind of is explained at the end, but, you know, it's not an ending that makes me, well, it makes other stuff make sense. It doesn't make the journey there for me any more satisfying.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's, if you Well, that's the thing. If you go into the film not knowing that it's going to have this weird story plot, especially even in the first 10 to 15 minutes, you don't really even know it, even as they get to the house. It's only as the film progresses, they start having these scenes that just come out of nowhere that kind of change everything, and it makes one wonder, you know, what's up with that. So it can be confusing if you weren't expecting that type of film. The first 5 minutes I was expecting, oh, all right, this is going to be like a Quentin Tarantino film, you know, and then of course by the time they get to the house, the mansion, everything kind of changes. To get back to what you said, Abe, why they're together and so forth. We do learn from flashbacks and a couple of times when they discuss, when they go to Daphne's mansion, we discover that they were childhood friends from like preschool days. So they've just remained friends up until, you know, their mid 20s now.
Yeah. But, you know, I was trying to figure out exactly why. Petula wants to be an actress, but Tilda, I don't think we ever really know what to do, and she's just tagging along or something like that.
You know? Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, so Tilda, it seems like a faller, I guess, but Petula doesn't necessarily seem like a authoritarian lead. In other words, she still treats her friend with dignity and respect, even if she's the boss. In the relationship, I think. So it's not like a sociopath friend and everybody follows them to soothe their fears and egg on their ego. It's more of a sisterly, in a sense.
Yeah, it feels like the Tilda character is just kind of caught in the middle between the two characters, and that's literally the game they play, because she's the daughter who's supposed to be sick, who's getting treated by the doctor, so she really is there, but that means she has agency of her own. We have no idea what her motivations are, other than that she swings back and forth between the two of them, and there's like a kind of a battle of control for her between Petula and Daphne. But it doesn't have a logical progression to it. We don't see it as a buildup. It's just more at the first, whatever it is about, when would you say that final, that her change in character comes? It's about halfway through the film.
About halfway towards a
60%, a little more, maybe a little more halfway.
Yeah.
Where she's
60%.
You're right. Yeah, the film starts
50 minutes in or so.
So the film starts. Well, not starts, but it's where they're beholden to Daphne, to Mother, because she's the one that has the money. They need to get the money from her. So we get the sense that they are, they're basically just placating her, right? They're in order to get the opportunity to find the safe and steal the money and blah, 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 blah. And that's a nice, easy setup. The problem is, of course, that Daphne's nuts. And so they end up placating her too much. But there it's clearly Petula and Tilda together against Daphne. And then at that twist point in the middle, or first twist point in the middle, it becomes Daphne and Tilda keeping Petula in the house. And we have no idea why Tilda switched to align herself with Daphne, because really Daphne up to that point, she's playing the mother part, but she's playing a terrible mother.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, kind of an abusive mom. She's not right in her head. So we don't know if this is how she thinks mothers are supposed to behave, because that's how her mom treated her or what, you know, so, but you're giving, you know, imagine, I guess, sort of like Annie Wilkes, you know, from Misery, and then Crazy, you know, it's just,
yeah,
you know, that's kind of where she is. It's, Yeah, so that is just what it is. So why, you know, again, it's off-putting, although you kind of, and even then I just in the after the final revelation, I still don't understand why she changed necessarily, other than that with the final twist gives you a rule for this that allows them to do any number of illogical things to have happened throughout the film.
You're right. We'll get into why Tilda switches, or at least my opinion, later, and whatever everybody else thinks. But basically, when they go, Petula continues to bring up these three rules they have to follow so Daphne doesn't throw them out or become, I guess, more insane. And I know two of the rules. One was no one leaves until the game is over, right? Yeah. And no one, no outsiders allowed. There's a third one. You know it, Abe?
Yeah, the
don't talk about Fight Club.
I think it's like play by the rules, no outsiders, and nobody leaves.
Okay, so play by the rules. Okay, so the
I wrote
rules
it
is,
down. Let me see if I can find it. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if it is that one, the rules are
everyone must play.
Everyone, that's it. Yeah,
everybody must play. Okay, right. And unfortunately for Tilda, they already have assigned roles for this game, and Tilda has to play the daughter. So she's the one that gets abused by the mother, obviously, and then when Petula has to do her medical skills on her, obviously, it's not going to go well necessarily, because one big scene they show is trying to find the funny bone on the knee, and she's forced to use by Daphne to use a meat cleaver or a meat tenderizer. Yeah, and yeah, that's not going to be too good. I actually wince when she did it.
Right, but even that, like, it didn't make a lot of sense to me. I was kind of waiting for the rules of the game to be made clear. Because unless the rules of the game are torture Tilda,
right,
why wouldn't Tilda have just kicked her leg forward? Because she's a grown woman. She's knows how to play doctor, or, you know, I'm guessing, right. Although not this kind of doctor. You know, and it's and Petula takes the just like, I'm sorry, I have to do it, and it just does it so easily. Like, it's this is, you know, this is part of the game. This is what we have to do. Why didn't you kick your leg?
Yeah,
She just tap it again with the mallet as opposed to grabbing the tenderizer?
Because I thought the leg could have been completely ruined at that point. You know, to bash the knee in, because she did draw blood. I mean, she actually gave her a hell of a whack. It seemed absolutely counterproductive to their plans of trying to get out of there.
Yeah, I actually, like I said, winced. I know that they did show flashbacks with the children when they were, you know, preschoolers. And Daphne was very abusive in the game when they were preschoolers to Tilda. And Tilda kept on saying, I don't want to be the daughter and whatever. And Daphne was playing the mother and hitting her and all this other stuff. So I'm thinking, based off of at least the first belief, what we think is going on, it's just them growing into adults doing the same thing, where Daphne wants her quote-unquote daughter, which is played by Tilda, to be abused fairly hard. And that would include, I guess, the meat tenderizer thing.
Right, now that also, and again, I think you could argue it's explained later, but like this one, why are they playing along? She's not like a big burly woman.
No,
they have her. No, she doesn't have bodyguards or henchmen around or a supervisor.
And you know, this makes me think of that movie Don't Breathe, where they had to try to sneak into the house to get the money from the man. The reason they had to be so careful was because the guy was. Even though he was blind, he was large, and he was also armed with a gun. Daphne,
and he was an ex Green Beret.
He was a tough customer, even without his sight. But yeah. Daphne is a tiny little thing. There was two of these women who obviously lived harder lives. They could have easily restrained her and tied her up and gone looking for the safe.
Or at least you would have thought they would have tried to outsmart her.
Yeah.
You know, we miss, and again, there's reasons for it, but we miss, there's no like real transition scenes. You know, there's no, you know, it's just like, hey, we're here. They show up, they start playing the game. Again, as an audience member following along the first time through, the behavior of the characters didn't, of the two characters that we think are not crazy, don't make sense to me.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from. I know there was a couple of things I was thinking. It's like, okay, maybe they're just going to go along and not treat her terribly, meaning Daphne terribly, is because they, a couple of things. One, they have to hide out from the cops. So if they get thrown out of this house, then or whatever, then they're in trouble. And they, if they tie her up and the cops comes looking for them, because that's possibly where they're going to go, one place is their hometown where they came from.
They're in Vermont. Not Vermont. Virginia.
It's Vermont, Montpelier.
They're in Vermont, right? They left New York City. I don't think the cops are going all the way up there.
Well, it was all over the news, right? That's the thing. So if it was big news, if it was a big news story, they may apt to do so.
Well, but even that seemed like weird because it was just a drug bust.
Right. Unless Petula's character was more, a little more famous than we first thought as an actress, right?
Right. But again, not something that I ever felt they followed up with. But anyway.
Sure. No, and that's fine. But I mean, obviously, that's the type of story. Semi-famous actress caught into drugs and BSMD or whatever the term is, could make all the front pages of any blog, in some cases, mainstream media as well, I would think. But that's a fair point either way, Mike. But if Daphne is incapacitated and the cops do arrive, then they would be in trouble because they wouldn't have the front to protect them, you know, because they can't answer the door.
Yeah, but they're already in trouble anyways. They're already wanted for drug possession and stuff.
Well, and that's what I'm thinking, is that they would also use the house as a hideout from the cops, at least until things blow over.
Yeah, but that they also have to stay there longer, which is just means they're relying on a crazy person to keep their cover longer.
Well, that's true. And so, yeah, I mean, there is a valid point. It's why don't they just make Daphne incapacitated and basically demand her to give them the code to the safe and then they can go on their way. And I guess, you know, some of these questions are kind of answered at the end when we find out what's really going on. But I could see how, while you're watching it, you could just kind of be asking questions like that. I remember the incident at a Ghostland movie from last year, and I was talking to Eric about it. That film kind of has some of those things too, where it's like, why would they still be in the house that one of them was murdered or hurt or whatever, raped and so forth, and all this other stuff. And then Eric tells me when I texted him, he says, oh, just wait, there's something's going to change. And sure enough, you know, that film has a lot of that as well.
Well, the other thing is that because of the way it's shot and directed and edited, it very much has a surreal drug induced haze kind of quality to it.
Right.
And I've mentioned before, that's usually not the kind of film that I like. And, you know, so this was really like aiming right towards the stuff that I really dislike to begin with in a tone. So it wasn't starting out on fair footing, right? At least not with me. You know, sometimes there's movies like that that I end up being surprised that I enjoy, but usually not. But so when you're dealing with a film like that, where everything is kind of that, ooh, isn't it kind of trippy? And look, and the camera swinging around, and you know, the character is doing weird things, and sometimes you just like kind of lean into it and you go, okay, well, that's kind of the, that's the thing we're in, man. It's a, it's sort of a dream logic, and you know, we don't have to have a logical progression. That doesn't work for me, but it will work for other people. But that, so, so within, I guess you could argue the rules of the style, you know, it's not a very deliberate film, like a Tarantino film, right? Tarantino films are very, you know, deliberately paced, you know, very carefully laying things out. And this is a little bit more Gonzo style. So yeah, the rules are a little loose. And so again, I can understand why some people are just going to roll with the film. If you're buying into the film, then you can just roll with it. I never bought in.
Gotcha. That's fair. Again, this is going to be a very divisive film, depending on one's tastes and whether or not they like Gonzo style, or whether they like you said, this weird druggy haze to the story, and some other films such as the Johnny Depp film,
Leaving Las Vegas.
No, that was the Nicholas. No, that was thing.
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
That's That's it. Yeah, I mean, that one is a fairly quirky film, a little more comedic. The Turkish film Baskin, or the guy's follow-up Housewife, for sure, most certainly Housewife, is another example of that. I would say Incident in the Ghostland, though Eric actually loves that film. And then this film, obviously, you mentioned a couple, such as Jacob's Ladder and whatnot. But again, this one has also, like you said, that cultish or art house feel to it that, say, Jacob's Ladder didn't necessarily have.
Yeah. If any of our listeners are wondering, we lost Eric. He's decided to go rewatch Green Inferno. That's why he hasn't said anything in a while.
No, I'm here. You guys are doing great. Keep going.
Oh, no. You're not getting out of this. You got to give some thoughts. Come on.
Well, let me ask you, Eric, since I brought up Incident in the Ghostland and that film.
I disagree that these movies are anything alike.
But that film has crazy things that happen that didn't really happen either.
Right.
So what made you enjoy that film tremendously, for example?
That was actually a good movie.
Okay, so it was easier to understand, maybe, or it just, you enjoyed it because it was a good movie. Another way.
This movie, I didn't understand what was being presented to me. Incident in the Ghostland, I understood what was being presented to me.
Right. And that's what you kind of said, Mike, right? You said that you understood some of it at the end, but
well, I understood.
If you rewatch it again, you would get a lot out of it, but you have no interest in rewatching it. But go on.
I don't know if I would get a lot out of it. I'm sure. I never didn't understand what was happening.
Okay.
I didn't understand why it was happening. Right, I guess is the big difference. Like, I didn't understand why, you know, there's three rules to the game. None of them are smack Tilda in the knee with a meat cleaver, or not a meat cleaver, a meat tenderizer. Why is she doing that? And the answers never really come until the answer is, because none of it makes sense. And that to me isn't a great explanation for leaving me confused the whole rest of the film. So I understood exactly what was going on. Oh, here's the cop. They killed the cop. They bury the cop. I understand all of that.
Right.
And then I understand, you know, twist number one comes, and then there's like another twist at the very, very end. Okay, and I get those twists. And they make the lack of sense earlier. They explain the lack of sense. They don't, rather, earlier on. They just don't necessarily make them make sense. But I mean, I understood the events. Like, it wasn't like, you know, a poorly shot action scene where I can't tell who's punching who.
Right. Yeah.
But I guess for me, right, if you're getting down to it, the fundamental twist is nobody has any motivation whatsoever. They could do whatever they want. The things that happen maybe happen or don't happen. It doesn't matter because of twist. And it feels like and I guess for that reason, as I'm talking it through, that's, I think, why the twist is kind of unsatisfying. Because when you look at, again, a Jacob's Ladder or a Sixth Sense, and no, just so everyone knows, they're not dead the entire movie. All right, I want to make it clear.
The audience is, though.
Right, in Jacob's Ladder, there are things that's happening to Tim Robbins' character that he doesn't understand, but he doesn't understand why they're happening, and he, just as the audience doesn't really understand why they're happening.
Well,
and he's searching for understanding as to why they're happening, but everything else is making sense within a logical progression for the most part through the film.
And at least in my estimation, in those movies that you just named, there's a reason for the twist, and if there's a reason for the twist in this movie, I don't get what it is. So if you know what it is, please explain it to me.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and we'll get to that shortly. Since Mike brought it up, let's talk about the cop. So there's a little cop.
Did anybody else notice that he's driving a black and white but wearing a trench coat?
Oh, well, it is Montpelier, even though it's a quote-unquote city. It's a city of like 20,000 people. So
he's total street clothes detective, but he's driving around in a black and white marked police car.
But again, that at least, see, that's one of the things that I get perfectly with the twist at the end.
Yeah, okay, I'll give you that one.
You know, that one makes perfect sense.
It's just like, yeah. All right.
So
there's other things that I don't understand if you're willing to accept that. But anyway.
All right, I'll have to hear what you guys think of this, why that makes sense at the end. But before
I don't. That's
oh,
why
actually, I think I kind of get it. But let's talk about him. So he's the like the local cop in Montpelier, Vermont. There's this hobo or indigent person that kind of bothers the girls when they come, not sexually, but he just says something crazy like. I don't know. So go to hell. You're going to hell or something. I don't know. Something stupid. He's playing the Harbinger. Eventually, the cop has this guy come in, and because he claims that he said he saw the two wanted girls. And since he already knows about the wanted girls based off of the fact that they're from Montpelier, he immediately goes to Daphne's house, who was their closest friend as a kid. And Daphne basically says she hasn't talked to them for years and doesn't know where they are. The cop hears something in the house, and Daphne says, if you don't have a search warrant, you know, goodbye. So the cop kind of knows that they're there because Daphne wasn't smart enough to say that it's the cat or something. And then the cop throws a shot at her saying, I still feel bad for you because both your grandmother and grandfather died on the very same day, and you inherited everything. So it's implied that Daphne may have killed her grandparents and whatnot. So basically just making us understand that Daphne's not just
She's not a normal crazy person. She's a murderous crazy person.
Right, yeah. So she's actually someone that's possibly dangerous as well, not just a crazy person.
Well, even if what she says isn't true or not, the fact that she tortures our main character so constantly in so many brutal fashions, that shows just how fucked up she is. I mean, one point after she captures her friends a second time, she gives Petula a Glasgow smile.
Yes, that was disturbing. Yeah, I didn't like that. That was bad. So she tortures the two of them, and yeah, that was after Tilda has joined up with Daphne at that point.
That was before, because this is when Tilda confronts Daphne about being pregnant, and then decides, and they try to trick her into going for that surgery.
Right, that's right. Yeah, okay. Yeah, so basically they try to trick Daphne into being pregnant so they could then make her incapacitated. And by doing that, they're going to have to give her a C-section or something.
Right.
Yeah. Right, and that's when the cop walks in and they have to take him out and then and whatnot. So there's a couple of scenes that are kind of intense. Let's see. So they kill the cop, they bury the cop, and then they flush his car down the local pond, similar to Norman Bates in Psycho.
Did any of that actually happen?
No,
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't think so.
Because, yeah, because there's the scene later on where she tries to check to see if the body was even still there, and there was nothing there.
Right. Right. Never mind what we learned at the end of the film anyway. And so, yeah, basically this film is an interesting film where there may be more than one character that's an unreliable narrator or possibly insane as well. And so forth. All right. So what else do we want to talk about before we get into some of the twists?
I just want to say, I know, Phil, you're mad at me because I keep on slamming on this film. But there was one point in the movie, the moment when I knew I was going to have to apologize to Dan after the movie was over, is when the detective was having a conversation with, I think it was Daphne, and the camera's on her, and then it cuts to the detective, and all of a sudden it's black and white. For no particular reason. And Dan just looked over at me like, what the fuck?
Now,
and that's the moment I knew I was going to have to apologize for making him watch this movie.
Mike, you actually did research on Reddit. What did folks say about the change in black and white? Was it partly to demonstrate certain things weren't real? Or
was it... I don't think anyone gave... The discussion wasn't in that in-depth.
Okay.
I was more laughing at some of the. It's 2 hours of women running around in a house waving their hands in the air or something. It was just weird. There were some weird comments, but yeah, nobody looked at it in depth in terms of the style and things like that. And again, something like that, there are times I enjoy that, and you know, there are times that I don't, and you know, I'll go back to. You know, Tarantino, when the Kill Bill, you have an animated segment. You have the section in...
you have a black and white section.
With the black scene, too. You know, I for whatever reason, I enjoyed it. Now, maybe it's because by the time we get to those, we're deep into the movie, I'm enjoying the film, and I'm going to be more willing to roll with those things. And those are both extended segments. And then afterwards, I found out why it was in black and white, and it made sense. That it wasn't for artistic reasons. It was because it would have gotten a different rating if it had been filmed in color, because there would have been too much blood on the screen.
Yeah, but don't forget, in Kill Bill 2, when she's talking to Carradine's character, it's in black and white as well.
That's in the flashback sequences.
Gotcha. Okay.
If I remember correctly.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It was flashback sequence.
But here it felt to me like that the black and white were just sort of random spurts of black and white here and there. And I didn't specifically take note of when exactly we got black and white and when we didn't. So if there's a pattern to be revealed in that I missed, you know, I'm perfectly willing to concede that. I have no idea. But watching it on the first run through, it feels like it's random, and let's do this shot in black and white, and then back to color. You know, it's just so that's how I felt.
Yeah, there was a lot of moments where they tried to do different colors. They even did one moment where everything was around them was turning like a purple pink, like almost, yeah. and then
or like a Dario Argento type of thing.
Yeah, and a lot of times it just felt to me they were, as I said earlier, that they were just trying to do things look stylish. Sometimes it's not used in ways I think would have added to the sense of themes and stuff like that, and because it's used almost like only a handful of times and weird moments, like as Eric mentioned, the confrontation between Daphne and the detective, which was a strange moment for that.
Right. Yeah, and that's the thing, is that I didn't notice it. I mean, it's there and it's blatant, but I mean, I was so engrossed with the film, I didn't really notice it. But I did finally notice it quickly after a couple of seconds, because Eric had mentioned earlier to me when I was texting him in the morning, a Sunday morning, and he was saying he hated the film, and some of the reasons why was because of that, where one scene it would be in color, and then they'd cut to the person they're talking to, and it'd be black and white, and it felt pretentious or whatnot. And yet, oddly, for me, it kind of did work, even though I had already, I guess, was expecting it, because, Eric, you had mentioned it to me. But either way, it didn't bother me. But I could see how some people would think it was bizarre and what was the point and whatnot. And then, yeah, the surreal colors. I mean, we've seen that, though, in a lot of films. Like A History of Violence. Like there's a scene in the locker room that is in all like greenish reds, and the lighting doesn't make sense for a locker room. And yet it's never really talked about as a problem. Like why was it there? But some critics mention it as a cool thing that Cronenberg added into that film. But obviously it didn't bother people. And again, maybe it was because when Cronenberg did it, his film was more straight A to Z, A History of Violence, unlike, say, this film here. But I don't know. All right, so any other items that we wanted to bring up before we talk about the twists and what the film was actually doing and saying? Any other scenes or anything? Anyone? Anyone? Bueller?
Nope.
No.
You?
No.
Okay. All right, so let's talk about the twists and things like that. So, yeah, what this film, I think, was trying to state is that most of this was a figment of the lead character's imagination. In other words...
Who do you mean when you say the lead character?
Petulia.
Petulia. She the blonde?
Yeah, she's the hot chick. Okay. I mean, they were all hot, but she was like the really hot
one.
Okay, so I did decode it correctly then.
Yes, you did. And the reason I know it's her and that it was in her mind and that they've been playing this game over and over and over, living in this mansion until they were in their probably 60s or whatever, is because there's a scene when I rewatched the film where they're on the train and she's chewing gum and she takes out the gum and like a lot of young people takes it and sticks it under the seat. And then there's a quick flash of like 4 seconds of a different seat that we're looking under where there's hundreds of pieces of gum. And also this diary or book there. So it's like they do the train seat, but then it switches to a sofa seat. And what it is she chews the gum and she puts it underneath the sofa in the house, not actually on the train as we think she is in the first run watching the film. And then what we gather with all the pieces of gum underneath the sofa, she's been doing this over and over and over each time they play this game continuously. In other words,
and I have a question. Yeah. Did the other two actually exist?
Yeah, yes. they did.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. They're whether it's drugs or they're just insane or there's some sort, yes, or some behavioral health issue. They all exist and they all are staying in the house. And Petulia is the only one of the three that wants to follow her dreams. And her dreams are to be an actress and to, you know, move to New York or whatever. And every time she leaves, her dreams turn out to be horrible. Meaning she becomes a druggie, she's BDMS. So, you know, I mean, assuming people...
BDSM.
Think BDSM, thank you. I'll just say S&M. I'll remember that. and though her dreams are in the shitter every time she plays the game, she still is trying to escape. And that's why one of the rules is no one can leave. And Tilda is, in theory, the sane one. And she's the one that's trying to tell Petula to not follow your dreams because you're going to get destroyed by the world outside.
and it's better to stay here. And Petulia is trying to say to Tilda that there's no life living here. And so basically the movie's trying to say there's got to be a happy medium between overprotection and basically jumping off a cliff for your dreams. And so
I think most people know that.
Yeah.
Right, right. And yeah, but these people obviously are a little different. One is crazy. The other one is too scared to even leave the house, which is Tilda. And then the third one is almost like a prisoner by the other two, which is Petulia. And I think she's probably the drug dream. She probably is on some sort of drug or something. And that's why she's just crazy herself. And that's the reason why she keeps on living in this fantasy world in her mind. And then the last scene, as you can see, is Daphne is now a 60 or 70 year old woman. The house is now falling apart because they've just been staying there and never repairing or whatever. And they're about to start the game over again for the umpteenth time, where they're now in their 60s or 70s. And being overprotective shows that you just crumble away and die, as they are in this house now where all the dishes are broken and there's dust everywhere and whatnot. Now, were you going to say something?
Yeah, well, I took it as the idea of, I do agree that it talks about the idea of trying to follow what you want to do for your life. I saw it's part of it is something that's moving past the threshold of safety into the realities of the world. The authority figures and the hard times and stuff like that. And returning to the game and everything like that felt like returning back to that fantasy world, the denial of facing that reality. And there was, you know, I feel like it's just, you know, kind of dwelling in that kind of almost like sugar rush of fake happiness, that kind of thing that you're trying to cover up the actual wounds of what you're dealing with and what you, of your failures and stuff like that. And the suit, and the, when each character in that the last scene before we see that last shot kills himself, is kind of I think it's supposed to show that it's basically they are trapped in this kind of repetitive hell to repeat itself. And that once they had quote unquote committed suicide, the cycle starts again.
Right. Exactly. And that's the thing, is that I think two of them are willing participants, Tilda and Daphne. And Petula is not a willing participant and would like to probably break out of the cycle if she could. But, yeah, go on, Mike.
Yeah, well, yeah, so we're dealing with a film in which there's not just one unreliable narrator. We have three unreliable narrators. And there is nobody else, for the most part, in the film, except for, as far as I could tell, except for maybe some of the flashbacks. But, you know, so the cop isn't really killed. I don't even know if the cop was ever really there, right? It would make sense that they were imagining him as part of the game, which would why you have a trench coat detective driving a black and white.
Yeah.
You know, because these are three women, and we see flashes that imply that by now they're old women that have never really been in the outside world. I don't know how they keep getting food or how she learned about BDSM, because I'm guessing they've been locked up in that house since way before the internet. Nevertheless, you know, that's...
You know what this reminds me of, actually? Part of the setup, it reminds me of We Have Always Lived in the Castle by Shirley Jackson.
Okay, explain.
Well, basically, it was about this family who's always stayed in the house in their village. I won't spoil it because I do recommend reading for folks to check it out. Read it. It's a short book, but it's pretty good. But something had transpired in the lives of this family, a murder. And ever since that murder had committed this mass poisoning, the remaining members of the family have always stayed in the house, always living there, always only come out barely at all to only pick up some groceries and stuff here and there. But they always remained in there. One of the characters was always afraid to leave. And there are even some characters. And basically, it just reminds me of the idea of always trapping yourself in this small, enclosed world for whatever reason and not leaving, no matter what opportunities could be there for you. And I think isolation is a very interesting theme to explore. I just think this wasn't explored as well here as it could have been. But sure, if you wanted one that's really interesting about that kind of stuff, with kind of a whodunit thing, I definitely recommend We've Always Lived in the Castle by Shirley Jackson.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, and that's the thing. Is it something that is this film really about isolation or not? And it partly is, but I think that's the reason why it doesn't work fully like that Shirley Jackson book, Abe, as an isolation story, because it's more than that, right? This is really not trying to just be an isolation. It's really being a story about, and let me see here. I wrote this down. This is what I wrote. I wrote, if you dream too high, you will be destroyed, fall off a cliff, and be crushed. But if you be too safe, you will just become decrepit or a shell of yourself. And this film is, like you said, Mike, which we should already know, which is you have to have some sort of medium. And I think because these girls are disturbed, that medium doesn't work, obviously, because they have issues. And so all we do is have two extremes, one that can't leave and one that just wants to escape. And Daphne, who's just there in the middle, almost... it's just insane. So, in other words, her insanity is pure insanity, while the other two's insanity are more like phobias, I think.
Right, and I guess part of the frustrating thing, although to be honest, again, I was ready to check out after 16 minutes, and there was nothing the film could have done in the last 10 minutes or so to have flipped my opinion on it. So... this isn't what lost the movie for me, but what's frustrating for me at the end is we never find out. All right. So wait a minute. So what exactly is wrong with these girls, these women, these whatever they are, you know, when did it happen? You know, was it the accident that they talk about when one fell and
from the treehouse
from the treehouse and ruptured her uterus or whatever it was that happened to keep her from having children.
Right.
And is the fact that she couldn't have children what drove her crazy? Was she crazy already? Were the girls crazy already? Or was that a later development? Have they ever actually been out in the real world, or have they been there the entire time? Were all the secondary characters fake? And if all the secondary characters were like and a part of their imagination, in which case, how did we see, the scene at the police station?
Right.
Or were they out in the real world and returning? So it's the idea that, again, if you look at Black Mirror, Black Swan, sorry, right? Black Mirror is the TV series. Black Swan, Natalie Portman is an unreliable narrator. You don't realize it at first, but by the end of the film, that it was mostly in her head. But all of the other characters' behaviors work in context of the film when you realize that.
Mm-hmm.
Here the problem is everybody is an unreliable narrator. We don't know who, if anybody, is real, and we can never go back and start to piece together what may or may not be the truth of what happened in its entirety. And again, some people may like that. I like it a little bit more grounded than that, so this film was probably never going to work for me. And it also gives them license to go back and say, all the shit we did that made no sense earlier, this is the reason it doesn't make any sense, because all the characters are crazy. Mm. And to me, that's we're allowed to do bad writing because...
It's unsatisfying.
Because it's all the characters are crazy. Again, unlike, say, a movie like The Sixth Sense, where you watch a film where you think you're following a story with one set of rules, a twist comes, you now find out there's a whole new set of rules, and you can watch the film from the beginning and see the same story twice with a different set of rules, and those rules now have an internal consistency that don't contradict what we saw before. You know, it just makes the story make sense in a different way. Here, the story doesn't make a lot of sense until the end, where the twist is that it won't make any sense going forward. You just understand why it doesn't make any sense.
Well,
and I'm not satisfied by a story that doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Well, they got the flashback scene, which you mentioned, Mike, when the three girls are, I guess, sane at that point, as you know, 8-year-olds or whatever. And what happens is Daphne is playing the game. They're all playing the game, and Daphne's abusing Tilda. And then Tilda gets angry and pushes, and Daphne falls out of the treehouse. And like you said, she gets in an accident where her uterus ruptures. She can't have children. She probably lands in the hospital for a while, and she's in a coma, at least when she falls, or at least unconscious. So she could have gone mentally ill or insane because of that. Tilda could have gone mentally insane or begin to have phobias of the world and all that because she was the one that pushed Daphne. So she goes nuts. And then the other one, Petula, sees this and is horrified, and she's the one that wants to run away and get away from the old town or find a happiness elsewhere because this obviously was horrible. So you could look at it that way. Obviously, this is just an interpretation because this film is really mostly interpretations or letting the viewer decide based off of what they see, what they want to think. And so I could look at it, and I kind of looked at it as Daphne went nuts from the fall, Tilda went nuts because she pushed, and Petula wanted to get the hell out because she was there and she saw something horrible. And you know, this isn't the life I want. But again,
right, but I you know, to me, that's not a terribly satisfactory explanation. If it works for you, that's fine. But I think this is a difference of, you know, it's read between the lines, and then there's so much left unsaid and left up to the viewer. You could write an awful lot of stuff and not have it necessarily agree with or contradict what's there.
Question: can anybody give me their thoughts on the significance of the title?
Braid.
Well, no, I think. One thing I was thinking about with the titles, with braiding, like with young girls, you sometimes do to get with each other, braid each other's hair and stuff like that. Maybe also the idea of being tied in a knot and almost a coil, you know, almost like a looping coil. Maybe.
Right. And not being a young girl at the moment. We do see the scene of them tied up like in the attic by braids.
But that's one scene. That's the thing.
That's one scene. But if I am correct, and ladies, we really men paid very little attention to the rituals that you do, and stuff that you take as commonplace and obvious. We don't get. But I think when you make a braid, isn't it actually three strands of hair twisted together?
Right.
See, that's going to go with it. Yeah.
So is that the idea that these three girls are all twisted and tied together?
Yes.
And knotted together, right?
They're connected together.
Yes.
And you know, as it said, it kind of coils and loops, showing that they're completely tied together in that loop that's going to almost go on endlessly. Because the braid we see them tied, wrapped up together is huge, showing that this coil they're stuck together in is practically endless.
Right, right. And yeah, that a braid is. I've actually watched girls on YouTube recently doing hairstyles because my younger...
Well, that gets creepy.
Well, my oldest daughter wants to see them because she wants to see how Rey from Star Wars does her hair with the three buns. So there's a girl... you search YouTube, and then there's girls that do it, and then someone at school had French braid, and so same thing. We had to watch it online. So, and then we bought a book for of all different hairstyles.
Whereas guys just go, I want to do my hair like Vin Diesel. So much easier.
That's right. It is true, the braids for sure, because I, like I said, I've seen the video within the past couple of days. It's three, and so yeah, they're tied together. That's an excellent observation. So I think that's where it comes, Eric. Does that answer your question? I guess.
I was going there myself. I was just wondering what everybody else thought. We're all on the same page.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm looking on the back of the jacket of the disc, and it says, yeah, it does have the three rules listed here, too. So I didn't even know it was on the back. Everyone must play. No outsiders allowed. Nobody leaves. So yeah, you're right, though, Mike. That would be my interpretation why the three are insane. Because obviously the chance that you're going to have multiple people with these major insanities all living together that aren't together because of they're in a sanitarium would be very unlikely, correct? Right?
Yeah, and that's, again, if you really want to think about it, and I'm sure you, if you wanted to, you could come up with your own explanations, like how are they getting food, and you know. So this girl was being, Daphne was being raised, I guess, by the grandparents that she claims to have poisoned. That could be a lie. We don't know. She seems mentally incompetent to me. You know, they all seem mentally incompetent to me when they can't really detect reality. So why authorities would let these three crazy ladies sit in a house and never leave? You know, without them all eventually ending up together in a sanitarium, or why isn't there a caretaker character who's there, you know, that you could argue is there to watch over her, you know, who's like, it wouldn't be an executor, but whoever was that would be in charge of the money that she inherited.
Yeah.
I could certainly see, you know, all these things that they could have been added to at least add that stable perspective to the film. Is it really important to the story? I guess not. You know, it's not fundamental to it, but it's one of those things where if you really just keep picking at it, it makes less sense, but some stories aren't meant to be picked at either.
Right. Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah, I mean, there's some things that are unanswered because most, I mean, when you really think about it, 98% of this film, besides maybe the last scene, takes place in the dream world rather than the real world. There's a couple of other scenes that are probably real world too, like when Tilda is, you find out Tilda's really the boss because she sends Daphne to her room and then basically goes on a tangent of why we should stay here and not run away. And then of course the gum scene with the bubble gum and where Petula discovers that she, you know, she's been doing this for a bit. So when I rewatched the film, I was going to watch the first 10 minutes no matter what, because that whole with the soundtrack and the Spring Breaker feel to it was awesome. So I was going to rewatch that again. And then when I was rewatching it, that's when I saw the first hint, which was the bubble gum scene. And then from there on, I said, oh, I just got to have to rewatch this straight through. And then I rewatched it a second time. And I saw all those things that suddenly added up why it was in Petula's mind mostly throughout. But, Mike, you did have a few good points. Is why did we see the perspective of the cop and a couple of times too, which wouldn't make sense.
But it's a film in which it leans into its nothing makes sense thing, right? So again, this is not a movie that's intended to, it's not a puzzle film. It's not like this little clockwork when all the pieces fall into place sort of thing. And I don't think it's intended to be that way.
Right.
And again, that's going to work against it for me.
But, right.
But people know that going in.
Well, yeah, and that's true, right? Like for example, Jacob's Ladder and even the film that you like, Eric, Incident in a Ghostland, even though they're disjointed somewhat like this film, the puzzle pieces all fall together at the end. While this film, even though there are puzzle pieces, like I said, in the first 8 minutes, you see the bubble gum scene,
there's still things that are left open that aren't puzzle pieces that are just there. And again, that is probably what would make this movie divisive to some. Because I remember even people who watched Jacob's Ladder were pissed at the end because it was too tidy. Never mind this film, which may be not as tidy enough. Let's see. Anything else anybody wanted to bring up specifically related to the twists and some of the scenes at the end that kind of give away what was actually going on?
I kind of said what I thought.
Yeah, I honestly felt that towards the end it started to really drag. I mean, that freaking montage of them running around like idiots in the house was just fucking obnoxious. Even the reveals and stuff couldn't really salvage everything else. I mean, for me, this film was... Even though I understand a great deal of it, I do have to agree with Mike. There's a lot of things left unanswered, and I felt there was also just kind of... It felt unsatisfying. I said a lot I could. I mean, you know, anything more it will just feel like more ragged. I mean, I had nothing else to say about the film.
All right, very well. Eric, did you have any other items that you want to bring?
Nope.
Related to some of the scenes.
I'm good.
Okay, the first viewer to count the number of words Eric Webster has spoken tonight wins a prize.
You guys are doing great. Keep going.
All right. There was another film that Eric didn't like once, and he was kind of quiet too. And I forget what episode that was, but it was some film. All right. So before we give our final thoughts, let's see. Eric, you actually do another podcast with your buddy Dan.
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askancity Podcast. That's spelled Askancity. You can find it on Stitcher, Google Play, iTunes, or Spotify.
And Eric, you actually are about to do a returning podcast with me and Mike?
Yes. Yes, that's right. Game of Thrones is coming back on the air. So the three of us will be doing our last season of You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast to cover season 8.
Very good. Now, Mike, you have a genre blog, and you actually are a participant on that Westworld podcast that Ms. Jones was talking about?
Yeah, I participate in Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, the Westworld podcast, which is currently on hiatus, as well as Searching for American Gods, which is currently literally in the middle of its second season, because we've done 4 episodes of what I think is an 8-episode season. And my blog is on Natural Selections, www.unnaturalselections.com. I've also made a couple of recent guest appearances on the Dorkening podcast,
Network, Wicked Horror Show. Yeah,
their network, The Wicked Horror Show, which you can find on YouTube. I don't know when those specific episodes are going to drop. They do stream live, but we interviewed the filmmakers for 2 movies I've talked about briefly on the podcast before. The Killer Clown Meets the Candyman. That was 2 weeks ago, and this week we talked with the director of Theater of Terror. And next week we're going to talk to... Mike Lombardo of I'm Dreaming of a White Doomsday. So they invited me on because I recommended all 3 films to the podcast, and so they invited me on to have a chat with them.
Very good.
And then I'm going to need a hiatus because I did like 6 podcasts in 7 days or something like that. And that's a lot.
And both of those directors, and I assume Mike Lombardo as well, will have Dark Discussions openings. They gave us a couple that Leo sent over to me, and when Mike Lombardo's on next week, he'll probably do one for Mike, too, and Mike will send one over.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it is kind of cool. Let's see. Oh, speaking of the American Gods podcast, Searching for American Gods, episode 4 picked up pretty good. That was a interesting discussion we had on that episode.
Yeah, episodes 2 and 3 were rough for me to get through because the episodes were thoroughly mediocre. So we couldn't bash them as horrible, and we couldn't, there wasn't much there to praise or to dissect. They were just kind of there. And I think the newer episode has a lot more meat to it, or a lot more interesting things going on, you know, and, it was far less tedious to get through, at least from the point of view of the podcaster. I have no idea what it's like to listen to it.
Yeah. It just got dropped today. So we'll see if we get any feedback. I know Kevin Letts gave us feedback the prior episode. So maybe he'll give us, I think he most certainly will give us feedback on this new episode four. Let's see. Eric, where are we going to be in June? June, I think. What days are those, Eric? Do you know?
Oh, don't do this to me. I don't know what the days are.
Wait, what is this?
ScaraCon is the event.
Oh, ScaraCon is
the first
June
weekend of June. I forget what the June dates are.
That one I know because of the problem. June 7th, 8th, and 9th.
Okay.
Yeah, so we're going to be at ScaraCon. What's that all about, Eric?
It's a horror convention.
Yep, and it's in Framingham, Massachusetts. It's a 3-day convention, Friday night, Saturday, Sunday. A lot of big people. Who's going to be there, Mike? There's going to be some big stuff there. People there, right?
There are. I know you have Cassandra Peterson, Elvira, who said I was amazing, is going to be there. You're going to have a lot of the cast and the director of the cult classic film Phantasm.
Well, I mean, we may have to do an episode on the classic Phantasm coming up.
So, yeah, we may, and I've been looking for
it. We haven't already.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, that's a film I saw once. I didn't particularly care for it, but I've been curious to watch it again because it was not at all what I was expecting it to be. And so that may have, maybe now that I have a better idea of what it is, that'll work a little better, like your follow. You know, I might enjoy it more.
Yeah.
I believe they just announced, was it Billy Zane is going to be there?
Oh, no kidding, huh? Wow. That's a big name, actually. That's pretty good.
You have Nightmare on Elm Street, Heather Langenkamp is going to be there.
Yeah, that's right.
The
lead actress?
Lisa Wilcox.
Who's she from?
She's from Nightmare on Elm Street 4 and 5. Amanda Weiss, also from Nightmare on Elm Street.
Wow. The lead actress from Sleepaway Camp, right?
Yeah, Felissa Rose.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Danielle Bisuti, who is from Insidious: The Last Key and Insidious Chapter 2.
A lot of announcements since the last time I hit the site.
Curse of Chucky. Yeah, so, yeah, well, they tend to hold on to their announcements until they get closer. So they tend to come in waves. And so, yeah, so Phantasm, it's Reggie Bannister, Michael Baldwin, Bill Thornberry, Gigi Bannister, and Don Coscarelli, who is the director.
Right. Obviously, Angus Grimm can't make it. He has unfortunately passed, but that's a pretty good...
We can arrange something.
There you go. He was an undead beast, so he may come back. You know?
Boy!
That's right. Excellent, Eric. Excellent. So that's going to be exciting. So we're going to be there. We're going to have a table, and we're also going to be interviewing some of the guests, and we're participating in the podcast, International Podcast Awards, Horror Podcasts and Genre Podcasts. A lot of folks are sending in their podcasts to be nominated and possibly win in various categories, including Best All-Around Podcast, Best Interviewer, Best Hosts, Best Short Form, Long Form, Best Comedic in a Horror Podcast, and so on. That's going to be exciting. And then, Eric, at the end of July, the weekend of the 26th, 27th, 28th, what's going on?
We are meeting up in Mystic, Connecticut for the third year in a row.
Woo!
Yep, that's right. And what are we going to do there?
Have fun.
That's right. So we're going to have a pizza at Mystic Pizza on Friday night, the 26th. 27th, we're going to go see most likely Quentin Tarantino's film and do a podcast on that at the theater. We're going to go and then probably go back to a local establishment, maybe Mystic Pizza again. Who knows? And
that's way too loud to do a podcast there.
Yeah, you're probably right. and then do the podcast
We have a good group of folks that are going to be there besides our podcast, all five of us, for Dark Discussions. We have a couple of members of the Dorkening, most certainly Leo Pond, Kevin may be showing up, Stephen Christina of I forget what his podcast is, he may be showing up, and then a couple of people on our Facebook group, I forget who they were.
And Mr. Watson is making noise about coming out. I don't believe him for a second.
Yeah.
He lives in Washington, so
yeah. Washington State.
You heard that, Mr. Watson.
I promised him a piggyback ride if he shows up, but I don't think he's showing up.
He's throwing down.
Well, right. And Holly Masiak said she may show up.
That'd be cool.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah. And then Sean Fox of Canada at one point said that he was considering it, too.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah, he's up in...
He's gone international.
I think, what's it, Alberta or something he's from? Yeah, so...
He's Torment, right?
Yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And then
maybe he can give you a piggyback.
I'm not gonna try and get anybody to do that.
I wouldn't mind seeing Gage Foltz show up too, because he actually was stationed in New London, Connecticut, which is the next town over, for a number of years for the U.S. Navy, and now he's out in the Seattle area. But maybe he wants to come back to his old haunts and visit people, and he could hang out with us too.
Perhaps.
Maybe he can pull in a submarine.
That's right. Oh, and. Tracy from Pop Horror, who lives in the greater Worcester area of Massachusetts, may actually join us as well. So,
that'd be awesome too.
Yeah. So we'll keep everybody posted. Right. Anybody else who's interested in Scarecon or Mystic, just email darkdiscussions@aol.com and we'll give you further details of hotels and all that and agendas and so forth. Mike, what's going on? At least me and you are on August 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th?
Yeah, that's August 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th. That's Scares as I Care weekend in Williamsburg, Virginia. All the profits of the convention go to the charity Scares as I Care, which you can find if you look up scaresasicare.org on the internet. You can find out all you want about that. Everybody who works for the charity is a volunteer. Nobody takes a dime working for it. Many of the celebrities who do attend to the convention do so either at a cut rate to help the convention out, or in some cases will donate some to the convention. I know last year Doug Bradley gave some money. Sid Haig has donated very generously to them over the years, and they've got they don't wait on their guest announcements. They've got a fantastic guest list, I think, this year, at least for me. If you're a fan of the old film Monster Squad, they have all the actors who played the Dracula and Wolfman and Frankenstein the Mummy.
Wolfman's got nards.
And he's the Wolfman's got nards. And they, you know, they also have professional photo ops with a lot of them. So you have a professional photo op with the whole group if you want to pay for that. If you're a fan of The Thing, well, sadly, they don't yet.
John Carpenter's The Thing.
They don't yet. Yeah, John Carpenter's The Thing. They do not have John Carpenter, and they do not have Kurt Russell, but they do have Keith David. They do have Wilfred Brimley. They also have
Windows. They got Windows.
They got Windows.
They got Fuchs. They got Fuchs.
And they got Fuchs. Right. So that's Thomas Waits and Joe Polis. And again, there's going to be a photo op for them. I don't know if they're going to get you all tied down onto a couch with them or how that's going to work. They've got Jeanette Goldstein and Mark Ralston from Aliens, who were Vasquez and Drake, and they're going to be there, and you can have a photo op with them with an alien. They'll have somebody there in an alien costume, so you can do that. Legendary composer Henry Manfredi from Friday the 13th.
Oh, no kidding.
Is going to be there. Sid Haig and Kane Hodder will be there, as they usually are. And there's lots of others. And then there's another good one, which is Joe Bob Briggs is going to be there. And he's doing a 2-hour show from 9 to 11 Friday night, which is the 2nd, I believe.
That's right.
An evening with Joe Bob Briggs. Tickets are $20 each. 160 have been sold. I have no idea how many more are available. I know I've got mine.
Oh, then I got to get mine, because I know Anthony Thurber got his, and you now have yours.
Yeah, and Anthony Thurber's coming down. Yeah, so and there are going to be more guest announcements, although my wallet will cry if there's any more that are there.
Well, and so, I just want to pop in and say that I made it to Scares the Care 1 year, and unfortunately they moved the date, so it's now held at a time when I cannot attend. But it's not because I don't want to be there, because it is fantastic. Fantastic thing.
They purposely moved it because it was they have a big horror author section, and it was the same weekend as NeCon, which is the horror author convention in Rhode Island, and so it was harder to get a lot of the authors because of that. So that's why they moved it. At least that's what I was told. And so now they don't overlap anymore, and so the authors can go to both if they want to. But yeah, the convention, like the Briggs thing, a lot of that money is all going to charity too. So even though it's $20 to see him, and it's in addition to getting tickets for the convention itself, that money also is going to go to charity too. So that's always a good thing.
Yeah, and I want to say again, if all the money is going to the charity, like last year, Father Evil, if you know Father Evil, who's done a lot of conventions, he did a photo op. It was a $10 photo op, but every dollar of that photo op went to the convention. It was maybe a $20 photo op. Many of the guests there, this is part of their livelihood. So when you get somebody like Joe Bob Briggs, who does an event like this and is giving that money to the convention, that is huge. You know, all money that's huge. That's all money that if he does that at other conventions, he pockets the money, you know, so he doesn't have to donate it. It is not a requirement for people to come to do that. The convention makes money off the guests, not the guests, the fans, you know, when the fans come, they pay their tickets. That's where they get their money, you know, so. But you get a lot of vendors make donations. A lot of the guests make donations. It is not something that's required of them. And again, a lot of them will come. And there are certain celebrities that I know we might see at ScareCon New England.
Yep.
And then we'll see at Scares the Care. And they're charging less at Scares the Care because they know fans are there supporting a charity. So they charge less for their pictures and autograph. Not all of them, but some of them will do that.
Right. Also, one group that donated that we should give dibs to, and the reason why it's staying in Williamsburg each year, is the hotel gave $7,000 back to...
Absolutely. Man, that hotel has to put up with a whole bunch of shit while the people are there in the hotel.
Oh, and they really get into it, though. The restaurant, the waitresses will dress up. They decorate the whole hotel. Yeah. You will see people because you're right down the road.
They have karaoke,
Six Flags, right? And so they do get people visiting like Six Flags or Colonial Williamsburg. Yeah. And you can tell you're in the elevator and it's like there's a group of people all wearing black T-shirts. And then there's like your family with swim trunks and little floaties on the child, and they're just like looking at the horror convention
goers. People in black get off the elevator.
But whatever amount, you know, Joe has to pay the hotel. Joe is the individual that runs the convention. He has to pay the hotel to rent the hotel. He gives obviously a big chunk for the whole weekend, and the hotel actually turned around and gave $7,000 back to Joe. So I mean, so that's absolutely huge.
Right, because they still sell at the hotel. They sold out in minutes, you know, the hotel this year when they first opened up the hotel block. I was fortunate enough there's a waiting list if you want to go to the website, the Facebook group. They have a waiting list, and, you know, you can trade rooms if somebody can't make it, you know, they'll give up their room. I was fortunate enough to be able to grab one. But there's lots of hotels in the area if you can't make it at the host hotel itself. But they sell at the whole hotel for the weekend, and... So the hotel obviously likes them coming back.
Yeah, the town, even though it's just a town, there's like 40 hotels in the town. So even if you can't get in, that shouldn't make you say, well, I guess I shouldn't go, because there's hotels, 40 of them within a 5-mile radius of where the convention is. So, and all of them are empties, meaning you can find hotel rooms. So it's not that difficult.
So that's another thing if you're interested in going to that. So that's a great convention, and Scarecon, the place that they do it now in Framingham, does similar stuff where the hotel, everybody is promoting it inside the hotel. They have the elevators that are filled with cobwebs and scary creatures and stuff. So and that hotel in Framingham is well known to have genre conventions. So that's a good choice too. Obviously that isn't a charity, but for an experience of a hotel, I mean, for a convention, if you're in the Northeast and you can't get to somewhere like Williamsburg, Scarecon is obviously a great opportunity too. Any other items we want to bring up about Scarecon, Mystic, or Skierzak here? Anything? All right, Abe, now where can folks find us on the web, and what can they find on that webpage?
All right, so if you want to pay us a visit, go to darkdiscussions.com. All episodes that we've done so far are up right now. You can listen to them for free. But if you want to check out something different from podcast episodes, you can look on your right-hand side of the site, and you'll find a link to different blogs and other podcasts. It may pique your interest. There's also the ferment, and yeah, as I said, it's all free. And we're doing a new episode each week that will be put up shortly. So there's no shortage of topics to talk about and listen to. So just drop by and say hello.
All right. And even though everything is free, as Abe said, Eric, what else do we have on the website that could really help the podcast?
I believe you're referring to the Patreon link, which I discussed at the beginning of the show. You can find it on the front page of darkdiscussions.com, or you go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. All the money that you give through the Patreon account is used to offset the cost of producing the show. There are, you know, stuff we have to spend money on, like equipment and server fees and everything like that. So, Every dollar that you care to donate is appreciated greatly. You can follow the link on the front page of darkdiscussions.com or go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions.
Excellent. All right, so let's give our final thoughts once again for Braid 2019. So let's start with you, Eric, since we started with you earlier.
All right. Worst movie of the year so far for me personally. I recommend that you run far, far away and never watch it.
All right, very good. I'll go next since I did before. This is by far the best film I've seen this year. One of the best horror films I've seen in probably 5 years. It will most certainly be close to my top five, if not the best film of the year, depending on what else comes out. I love this film. It was awesome and it rules. So, if you like art house horror, high recommend. But as Mike mentioned earlier, it will be a divisive film because of the type of film it is. Abe?
I was not crazy about this film. I wouldn't call it the worst film in the world. But for at least 2019, it is definitely one of the lowest experiences I've had. I can't really recommend it. It's kind of a mess of writing. It leaves a lot of things unexplained. It's performance is obnoxious. Its characters are unlikable. It's actually kind of mostly just awkward to sit through. It's not a fun experience, at least for me. And you know, I just don't think I would. I don't. It's not something that I have a place on my list. Just, you know, this year I just, you know, this. I honestly think this. No way. Just definitely no way. I can't really say anything good about it. So I'm just going to stop right there and move on from there.
All right, Mike.
I want my 2 hours.
Actually, it was 81 minutes, was it?
I want my 81 minutes.
It feels longer. Minutes. It feels longer.
Yeah, look, I'm not going to beat up on Phil for liking this. It's not like he liked The Gallows. There are stylistic choices in this film and narrative choices that go against my grain. And I do not like it for those reasons. I like the performances in it. I probably should have pointed that out much sooner. I didn't really notice the music in it. But I just, it just didn't work for me. But you've heard us say what didn't work. And if you're like, if you don't mind films that have a loose narrative, you know, if it doesn't have to make that much sense to you, then, hey, you know, why not give it a shot? Again, there's not a lot of reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, but it does have an 88% positive rating at the moment. You know, there's only, I think, 13 professional critics who have reviewed it. So somebody's liking it, and if you tend to align with those critics, you know, then...
17 critics now.
17? Okay. Yeah. Four more. Still a very small sample size. You know, but if you like what those critics say, you know, I would read about it. I would read the good and the bad, but because I don't think that there's always going to completely differ on that. It's just some people like pineapple on pizza, and then the rest of us deserve to live fruitful lives.
Yeah, very good enough. Speaking of the people in front of the camera, as Mike mentioned, Matt Zoller Seitz from RogerEbert.com wrote, "I came away feeling that I'd seen, if not a major film, then a film by major talents." And that's how I feel. So that's how
you
I feel.
You already gave your opinion. Stop doubling up.
Fair enough, fair enough. So that was Braid 2019, a brand new film. You can find it on VOD everywhere. It's also on disc, only in the North America as a DVD, though, not as a Blu-ray.
Because they don't like you.
No, it's probably because media is dying and everything's going VOD.
Well, talking with the director of, I think it's Tom Ryan, director of Theater of Terror the other night on the Wicked Horror Show, because they did offer their film in Blu-ray and DVD. It's the first time he's done Blu-ray, and the reason he's always been reluctant to do it is that it's just much more expensive, I guess, to make the Blu-rays than it is to make the DVDs. So I'm guessing that's why an awful lot of these independent films just do DVD and do not do Blu-ray.
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense. Holly Masiak just instant messaged me back because I mentioned that we randomly picked Devil's Advocate, which was her pick, and she said it, she screams out, "Yes, I'm so excited to hear you guys talk about it." And she, of course, she uses the black heart because of the goth look rather than the red heart. Indeed. So indeed. So congratulations to her. And yeah, we're looking excited to talk about it because I think all of us who have seen the film actually liked it a hell of a lot. So I think we got a lot of good stuff to talk about when that episode comes out. Mm-hmm. So once again, Braid 2019, 88% on Rotten Tomatoes, divisive film, but maybe worth a watch if it sounds like your cup of tea. So with all that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right, thanks for tuning in. Let's talk about Braid. Come back next week. We'll have a better topic.
No.
Yeah. Yes.
Yes.